Thank you very much. And it sounds like you may be able to empathize with some of these people I'll be talking to you about today. So thank you for coming, first of all. It's nice to see so many people here. And the big question that's shaped my own research career is the question of how different teaching approaches affect students' learning of mathematics. Tonight I'm going to be talking about a related question that's been very important for me, both as a teacher and in my research, and that's the question of why girls don't go forward in mathematics in the numbers that we might hope they would, and in some cases also underachieve. Now, I have science in my title. I'm actually going to be talking almost exclusively about maths, but there's a bit of artistic license there, but I do think that everything I'm going to say about maths applies to other conceptual subjects, particularly physics, and I'll talk a little bit about physics. So I've been fortunate enough, as Michael said, to study these questions in different countries. First at King's College London, then I was at Stanford University in California, and here at Sussex. And today I'm going to draw across those different studies to consider the main factors, or one of the main factors, that impede girls' progress in maths and science. So first of all, where are we in terms of gender and achievement in maths? I'll show you a few statistics to highlight. First of all, the achievement question. And the big sort of perspective I was going to give on achievement is to say that for a long time now, girls and boys have been achieving equally in maths in school. This statistic shows you something that's actually a little bit worrying, that might not look worrying to you, but last year in GCSE, slightly more boys got A star to C grades. What's worrying about that is the first time in 12 years that boys have gone ahead of girls, and has been very clearly related to the fact that coursework, where students work on bigger projects, has been taken out of the GCSE. So when that happened, and that was an area that girls particularly enjoyed and worked on, there's been a slight shift in achievement, but pretty equal for the last, as I said, this is the first time in 12 years that boys have gone a little bit ahead. More worryingly, and again related to recent policy shifts, at age 11, when students take a Key Stage 2 test, again, very recent statistics, and for the first time in a long time, girls are now underachieving at the age of 11. And I see that as pretty worrying and very directly related to things that are happening in schools, which I'll come on to a bit later. At A level, we see, again, the strong performance of girls actually get more of the A to C grades than boys do. Less of them take A level, but those that do perform very strongly. So big picture on achievement is it's equal. This is despite what, you know, the other messages you might get from the media and elsewhere. But participation rates don't look as rosy as this. And in fact, I think we have some particular problems in England with the participation of girls. And these statistics show you the percentage of those taking A-level maths who are girls. And you can see in England, 38% of A-level students are girls. And some people might think that that's a statistic is okay, but when we look at other countries, even inside the UK, you can see that England's doing particularly badly on that, and I do think we have a particular English problem. In other countries as well, in the United States, participation is equal at high levels, even at degree level. So in England, every year about 15,000 more boys take maths A-level than girls. You know, there's no particular reason for that other than, well, some things I'll talk about. So, and then the other thing I wanted to mention is we have a nation of maths traumatized people, unfortunately. I don't know if any of you, any people here would put themselves in that category, particularly women. And I'm not talking about women who've sort of left school with few qualifications. Highly competent, highly intelligent women with achievements all over the place will very frequently say that they're scared or traumatized by maths. And this really came home to me recently when I had a book come out and I was interviewed on a range of BBC radio shows and also in a range of radio shows across the US. I was interviewed by about 30 different radio presenters. Nearly all of them women, nearly every single one of them said to me, "Oh my God, I'm terrified of maths. I didn't want to do this interview. Jane Garvey, presenter of Woman's Hour, I was interviewed on Woman's Hour. She started off by saying to me, I'm terrified of maths. I've already told my daughters I'm terrified of maths. Here's a highly competent, intelligent woman, can talk on any subject. So there really is a big issue. And in a lot of these radio sessions, I started off by saying something I often say, which is that I think maths is a really traumatic subject for many people. And the way it's taught is actually very traumatic, and I use that word sort of quite seriously. But at that point, a lot of these presenters sort of really relaxed and kind of opened up, and a lot of the radio shows became like therapy sessions while I was sort of saying, it's okay, I understand, and we talked through some of their issues. But this is one of the presenters from Wisconsin, from the States, Kitty Dunn, and she said, the name of my high school algebra book is burned into my brain. And this is the sort of emotion that you get from bad maths experiences in schools. So, and one of the things I would argue is that when people have a bad experience of maths, unfortunately, maths is often taught in a very narrow way that only some students are able to engage with. And if you're not one of those students, often you don't just think, well, maths isn't one of my subjects, but it can be very sort of traumatic and make people feel really undermined. And another, well, you would be a good example of this too, Michael, but a high-achieving person. But another super high-achieving scientist, Vivian Parry, who is a science writer for The Times. She's a presenter of she's a presenter of Tomorrow's World. Super successful scientist. Couldn't do maths at school, did badly at maths at school. And this was her talking on Radio 4 recently, saying, this has pursued me through my whole life. It's so undermining of your whole being to be so bad at maths. You just feel so stupid. And she talked, and also Lenny Henry was on the show with her. They both talked about how everybody knows that if you're good at maths, that means you're smart. And so, you know, if you're not good at maths, that means that you're stupid, as she said. So a lot of people have really very strong emotions, very negative experiences of maths. So that's kind of where we are in terms of achievement and participation. But the question is why? Why do these inequities prevail? Why are they distinctly English? And why do so many adults have such bad experiences with maths? And so, you know, girls aren't going forward in the numbers that we would hope. And I'm going to talk about two broad sources, the first one quite briefly. And the two sources I'm going to talk about are society and schools. Moved. So first of all, society. And I want to tell you about a couple of societal factors that I think we have working against us. One, this comes from an interesting research study, I thought, that they found that when mothers tell their daughters, I was no good at maths at school, their achievement immediately goes down. And as we know, we have a nation of sort of math traumatized women, in particular, as well as a lot of men, then we know that there are, you know, that's a serious problem for us. But it's not just mothers who give out negative messages. There's a general belief that's put out by the media that maths and science are really for men and boys. If you go into a mother care store, which I've been doing in recent years, you go into a big mother care, you'll find that the toys are divided for boys and girls, even from birth. They're divided for boys and girls. And, of course, the boy toys have much more sort of mathematical and scientific things in them. I was talking last week to the maths advisor for West Sussex, whose niece was asked in her school assembly in front of the whole school to say which subjects she liked and didn't like. And she said that her best subject was something and her worst subject was maths. And the head teacher said to the whole school gathered there, well, that's okay, because maths is a boy's subject anyway. It's pretty shocking, really. But so I would put up there, unfortunately, negative messages come from all sorts of places. And I often, sadly, hear of children in primary schools who are told by their teachers, probably trying to be very sympathetic, don't worry about maths. You can be good at other things. So a lot of negative messages. But society's reaction is also worth thinking about, because what I find interesting, and others have commented on, is for many, many years, girls were behind boys in maths and science. And what was interesting about that is when girls were not doing as well as boys, and people reacted to that. Society in general, really, the reasons they came up with were internal to girls. There's a lot of talk about maybe girls aren't suited to maths and science. It was also just accepted. The president of Harvard famously or infamously made similar remarks just a couple of years ago, saying maybe girls just aren't suited to science. It's not in their sort of brains. And but then girls caught up and then they overtook boys. And of course, there's now a huge, that's the other thing, that when girls were underachieving, a few gender researchers looked into it. When boys started underachieving, there were big national forums. We had, it was all over the TV. There was what people have called a moral panic set in. But also, when people discuss boys' underachievement, they talk about external reasons. So the reasons that have been put forward for boys underachieving, the schools, the textbooks, the teachers are too female-oriented. Nobody ever says, well, maybe they haven't, you know, got the brains for it. So that's an interesting thing that we have in society, and it goes a long way back. In 1897, they noticed that girls were kind of bright and chatty. They did a lot of reading, I think, and the boys were less so. And at that time, Reverend Bennett, I love this quote, argued that boys appeared slower and duller than girls because gold sparkles less than tinsel. And, you know, these ideas might seem ridiculous to us now. Little girls are made up, I also have in my title, of sugar and spice and all things nice. These might seem ridiculous, but there are real vestiges of the idea that actually men are intrinsically more suited to maths and science in England now, still in these days. So there's, you know, things going on in society that we have to think about and look to when we look at the achievement of girls and the participation of girls. But I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about things that are happening in schools. And I'm going to start on a kind of journey which goes back to a study I conducted when I was at King's that's quite old now. And I was, those who heard me speak about this study at the Royal Institution, I'm going to talk tonight about the gender aspects of this study because it's been an important sort of journey for me that started with that study and moved on, as I'll show you. But anyway, so I'm going to tell you about a study. There's a study of two schools. And the schools were called, I called the school at Amber Hill and Phoenix Park. And both schools were in very similar, mainly white working class areas of England. And before the students attended these schools, they'd experienced the exact same approaches in maths. They'd achieved exactly the same test scores in maths. So this was a kind of experimental study where the students arrived at these two schools with the same achievement, same background. And then I followed them over 3 years. And the two schools taught maths differently. And I conducted hundreds of hours of observations in lessons. I gave questionnaires out every year. I interviewed students and teachers. And I assessed students in a range of different ways to really find out how these different approaches were affecting their learning. And I'll tell you first a bit about the two schools. So Amber Hill School was a traditional comprehensive school where the maths was taught traditionally. This is sort of traditional mathematics, where the teacher would demonstrate methods from the front of the room, and then the students would practice them. They'd work through questions in their books. It was very much focused on the exam. The students are put into one of 8 sets or ability groups. At Phoenix Park was completely different. There was no uniform at the school. There were very few school rules. Students were taught to be responsible for their own actions. The students were in mixed achievement groups right the way up to GCSE. And the approach they used was project-based, so they would give students bigger kind of problems to work on about the world or about sort of shapes or whatever. And the students would work on them for a few weeks of lessons. And if they needed to learn a particular method, the teachers would teach it them within the project so that they could solve it. And the students would discuss maths, and it was sort of a very different approach. And what I found was completely different gender responses from students at the two schools, which is what I'll tell you about. So at Amber Hill, as I mentioned, in lessons, the students sat, watched the teacher demonstrate methods, and then they practiced them. They did that in every lesson for 3 years. Apart from 2 weeks of each year when they worked on their coursework lessons, and then they were given bigger projects to do, and they, you know, that were more like how the Phoenix Park students worked. And most of the students at Amber Hill found maths to be both monotonous and boring. It was not popular, really, with any of the students. In a questionnaire where I asked students to describe their best ever maths lesson, 65% of girls and 61% of boys chose their coursework lessons as their best lesson. None of the students chose textbook lessons. All of the rest of the students chose the lesson, like when the policewoman came in to talk about safety, road safety, and other non-sort of mathematical things. But so although both boys and girls really didn't like the textbook procedural approach they experienced, they reacted to it differently, and I've described this difference, or I described it as a quest for understanding. So what I meant by that was what I found throughout the 3 years I was there, that the maths would be presented in this sort of procedural way. The girls, much more than the boys, more frequently would keep asking questions. They really wanted to understand what they were learning. So they really wanted to understand the methods they were given. They wanted to know why they worked. They wanted to know how the methods were linked. But they sort of wanted to locate them within a broader mathematical domain. And this was particularly acute for the girls, not because they understood less than the boys. They understood the same as the boys, but they really appeared to be less willing to give up their desire for this deep kind of understanding. And this is a typical comment from some of the girls. They said, he'll write it on the board and you end up thinking, well, how comes this and this? How did you get that answer? Why did you do that? But you don't really know because he's gone through it on the board so fast, and because he understands it, he thinks we all do and we don't. That's two students from the top set. Many of the boys didn't like their textbook lessons either, but in the absence of this being able to sort of think and understand the mathematics, they shifted their goals, it seemed. So they related more to speed and getting through lots of questions. And so these were typical comments from the boys that I never heard from girls in the school. They said things like, I don't mind working out of textbooks because you can get ahead of everyone else. And I don't know, the only maths lessons you like are when you've really done a lot of work and you're proud of yourself because you've done so much work, you're so much ahead of everyone else. So both of these boys are emphasising like relative performance and competition. Now, these were not particularly beneficial goals for them in the long term because they just came to see maths as this sort of rule-following game that they did quickly. But as a coping strategy, it was probably more productive because the girls continued to want more. They wanted to understand, and they became anxious when they couldn't. But as a number of different data sources, I really became convinced that it was a preference for understanding that really separated many of the girls from many of the boys. And when the girls found that they couldn't get understanding, they really started to back off from maths and underachieve. So this is one of the girls saying, I just try and do it now. I don't know what it means. I just try and work fast. In a questionnaire, I asked students to rank. I gave them five areas of mathematical work and asked them to rank them in terms of importance. And again, significant differences came out. 91%, big overlap, but 91% of girls, 65% of boys said understanding was the most important part of maths. And these different responses were also evident in lessons, where you would see boys kind of racing with each other, trying to get questions finished, and the girls would be much more frequently asking each other, usually, because the teacher didn't help them that much if they asked questions like, why does this work? Where does this come from? And often they'd get the questions right. It wasn't that they weren't getting them right, but they wanted more. This is one of the students saying, it's like you have to work it out and you get the right answers, but you don't know what you did. You don't know how you got them, you know. Both girls and boys valued working in groups and discussing maths, but the girls were really enthusiastic about it, whereas a number of the boys, it kind of conflicted with their desire to finish things quickly. So this was one saying, well, it could have been useful, but you could do it in half the time yourself. Like, you speed along, you understand it, next topic. But it slows you down the rest of the class. So a lot of very, very different comments coming from girls and boys in this traditional approach. And ironically, perhaps, it was the most able girls in this school who seemed to want to understand in depth. But it was also the most able girls who were not able to do so because they were in the top set, and the top set just worked quickly and went through things. So at Phoenix Park, at the other school, the students, as I said, they worked on a bigger project. They would talk about maths. They would discuss different methods and think about why they worked. And the girls at Phoenix Park were happy. They were confident. The girls at Amber Hill were anxious and unconfident. And the performance at Phoenix Park was equal. At the end of year 11, all of these students I'd been following for 3 years took a GCSE exam. And at Phoenix Park, they significantly outperformed the students who'd gone to the school learning traditionally, even though their projects they worked on were nothing like the national exam. So that was kind of interesting. But also, at Phoenix Park, the results were equal. At Amber Hill, 2/3 of the highest grades were achieved by boys. So very much a case of girls becoming disaffected and underachieving. Soon after that, I moved to Stanford, and in one of the first studies I conducted at Stanford, I was working in six schools, and the schools, we were looking at students in calculus classes, so quite high-achieving students, and all six schools used the same calculus textbook, but in four of the schools, the teacher just showed them the methods and the students practiced them. In two of the schools, the teachers had discussions with them, and they would all talk about these methods, like where they came from and how they worked, and very interesting again that in the schools with discussion, the achievement was equal. In the more traditional teaching, the girls weren't achieving or dropped out of maths altogether. And some of the students this is some of the students who were in the traditional classes in the US saying, "We knew how to do it, but we didn't know why we were doing it. And we didn't know how we got round to doing it, especially with limits. We knew what the answer was, but we didn't know why or how we went around doing it. We just plugged into it." And I think that's what I really struggled with. I can get the answer, I just don't understand why. And so very similar, again, it wasn't a study where I was looking for gender differences, but again, the girls started talking in the same ways. And another couple of girls saying, "I'm just not interested in, you give me a formula, I'm supposed to memorize the answer, apply it, and that's it." And I said, "Does maths have to be like that?" And she says, "I've just kind of learned it that way. I don't know if there's any other way. At the point I am right now, that's all I know." Two researchers from Hebrew University in Jerusalem took this notion of this quest for understanding and looked to see whether it's prevalent amongst students in physics classes. And they looked across 400 high schools in Israel and found resoundingly the same results. And they published talking again about the way girls were talking, and when they were forced to memorize these ideas in physics without understanding them, they said it was driving them nuts, is the way they put it. And their conclusion was very similar to my own. They said, although both girls and boys in the advanced physics classes share a quest for understanding, girls strive for it much more urgently than boys and seem to suffer academically more than boys do in a classroom culture that doesn't value it. So, why might girls and boys, if they do, why might they have these different preferences? Excuse me. I thought I would share with you a couple of controversial possibilities. And, leave them out there for you to think about and we can talk about. And the first one is quite old now, but was suggested by Carol Gilligan. So many of you will know a very famous book called In a Different Voice that came out in the 80s. And Carol Gilligan is somebody who studied moral decision making. She interviewed lots and lots of people and talked to them about how they make decisions around moral issues of morality. And she proposed that there were really two types of thinkers. Connected thinkers who use intuition, creativity, they draw on personal experience, and then what she called separate thinkers who use logic and rigor and truth and rationality. And controversially, she claimed that women tend to be connected thinkers and men separate thinkers. Now, Gilligan's work met a lot of resistance over the years, but it's also received a lot of support, particularly from women who identified with the thinking styles that she described. I'm not sure she had a lot of good data to support it, but an interesting and very influential sort of study that's out there. But now we have some even more, perhaps, controversial and interesting work that's coming out from studies of the brain. And there are certain researchers now who are looking at brains, sort of scans of brains, where when people are working on different tasks, and some of them, and Luanne Brizardine is one of them, are concluding that there's actually an astonishing array of structural, chemical, genetic, hormonal, and functional brain differences between men and women. One of the things that they get people to do is perform maths tasks, interestingly, and they sort of look at the scans, the images of brains while they're working on maths tasks, and what they're finding is that girls and men and women perform equally on these maths tasks, but use different circuits of the brain to solve the problem. So that's kind of interesting. And at this point, I think I should say maybe something a little bit about essentialism. I guess if there are, I know that some of you here are researchers of equity issues, and as a researcher of issues of equity, I think red flags start waving around the time when you start thinking about men and women being so different as having these sort of brain differences. And I think it's important with all studies of equity to acknowledge that it's not all girls who have preferences for, you know, inquiry sort of thinking, or and certainly not all boys who like just to be given rules and go quickly. I'm sure there's lots of men here who don't like that and women here who might do. But and even with the brain imaging results, I think you have to, what we have to acknowledge is that the brain researchers see the brain as a certain, and gender issues of the brain on a kind of spectrum. So they'll talk about the male brain, the classic male brain, the classic female brain, knowing that actually all men don't have this male type brain and all women don't have this female brain. So I would say that with this, with the brain studies, with all of the things that I'm talking about as well, you have to be very careful to acknowledge that these are, you know, tendencies that we see amongst groups of people. But I also think it might be dangerous to ignore some of the recent research that's coming out. And I'm going to show you a few facts which I think are pretty uncontroversial that's coming from the brain research and see what you think about them. So these are three of the most interesting, I think. They know, researchers know, that there's a huge testosterone surge that begins in the eighth week of pregnancy, which kills cells in the communication centers of male brains. We always laugh at this. And grow more cells in the sex and aggression centers. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that, you know, I think boys probably are more aggressive on the whole than girls. But and in the brain centers for language and hearing, for example, women apparently have 11% more neurons than men. So there are differences in communication, people are saying, and the fact that autism, which is a communication disorder, affects 8 times as many boys as girls is thought to be due to the fact that men's brains offer less support for communication. Interesting. Another study performed at Cambridge University by Simon Baron Cohen, who's a famous brother, and they did a study which was interesting, where they took babies on the first day that they were born, and they offered them a mobile or a woman's face to look at. And the researchers didn't know the sex of the babies. And what they found was that boys were twice as likely to look at the mobile than they were the woman's face. And they conclude from this that sex differences in social interest must be biological. It was the conclusion they drew from the study, because this was on the first day on the planet. And then the other thing that's kind of not too controversial, I think, is that they're finding that brain function in men is more compartmentalized. So one of the main ways they know this is, here's a picture of typical man and woman from, according to clip art, both wearing gray suits and enjoying their mobile phones, you can see. But the differences between men and women that they know is that if a man has a stroke, then he's disappeared. Didn't mean to do that. If a man has a stroke that involves the right hemisphere of the brain, he doesn't lose any verbal IQ points. But a stroke involving the left hemisphere drops, he immediately will drop in 20 IQ points. Whereas women, when they have a stroke on the left hemisphere or the right hemisphere, the points, it affects their verbalizing sort of equally. And so the researchers conclude from this that women use both sides of their brain for language and men don't. And these are some pretty significant differences, I think, that they're finding between the brains of men and women. But even talking at the point of sort of the dangers of going down the path of thinking men are like something and women something else, is that even in brain research, what they know is that the brain changes as people experience different things. So even when they find differences in the brain, they don't really know always where those have come from. So it's a very sort of contentious and unknown, I think, at this point exactly what all this means. But some of the researchers have concluded that women's brains are hardwired for connection and communication. And there's a number of books out now with whole educational programs about this, really saying that the brains of women and men are different and that girls and women actually need connections and need to be discussing in ways that are different for men. So, as I said, controversial, and we can talk about it. But for me, the question of why girls and women appear to need connections and to inquire deeply is probably less important than the fact that they do, and I'm pretty convinced now that they do, and the fact that in most mathematics classrooms, certainly in England, they don't really get the opportunities for the kind of deep inquiry that would support the preferences that girls and women have. So I'm just going to give you some final points before we're going to watch a video together of a classroom that I hope you'll find interesting. And my final point is this. I've proposed that girls need, or many girls, I should say, need a sort of deep inquiry approach to mathematics learning, where they're connecting methods and thinking about why they work and how they work, for whatever reason. But the good news is that the classrooms that offer a connected inquiry approach to mathematics benefit all students. So we know that when students get to talk about methods, to reason, that's sort of mathematical word for the why questions, to connect methods, to conduct deep sort of inquiry, that all students, boys and girls, do better. And that is why the Phoenix Park students did better than the students at the other school, and also why there were no gender differences there. So that's, you know, we know that the approach that's good for girls is good for everybody, which is good. Also, an approach where students are making connections and deep inquiries is much closer to the maths of the world, and it's closer to the maths that mathematicians use. And I've argued elsewhere that school mathematics typically is a very narrow, inauthentic version of the subject that's nothing like the maths in the world, and it's nothing like the maths that mathematicians use, and that's the reason that so few students find it appealing. Excuse me. Also, classrooms that focus on reasoning and talking rather than just rehearsing methods are ones in which all students can work together. It doesn't matter that what their prior achievement is if the problems are right, and you don't have to put them into these artificial ability groups that trap them into particular achievement range. So, to illustrate the difference between the mathematics that we have in schools and the mathematics that we should have in schools, I'm going to spend just a few moments by showing you some primary school maths. Because I think in primary classrooms, a lot of the issues are just accentuated versions of what we see in secondary education as well. So instead of those classrooms where students are conducting deep inquiries and talking about maths, we teach students much too much, and we teach them much too young. So to illustrate this, I'm going to show you a slide now, which comes from the national curriculum in England. It's the mathematics that's meant to be taught to students who are age 4, 5, and 6. So this is Key Stage 1 mathematics. I'm going to show you 1/10 of the mathematics curriculum. So there's 10 times, there's many more areas. And remember that primary school teachers have to teach all the other subjects as well. So this is a tenth of the maths curriculum for our youngest children. And I won't expect you to read all that now, but you know, if I just read out a little bit from the bottom, part D, develop a range of mental methods for finding from known facts those that they cannot recall, including adding 10 to any single-digit number, then adding and subtracting a multiple of 10 to or from a two-digit number. You get the idea. For many of our children who start to learn these abstract methods at age 4, the first experience they have of maths is that they can't do it. And in other countries that are very much more successful than we are, they don't teach formal methods to children until they're 7. We start teaching them these methods at 4. So what I think we should be doing, it's not that children of ages 4, 5 and 6 shouldn't be doing any maths, but they can be exploring with numbers and shapes and getting the idea of maths. And this is just an illustration of a sort of conceptual path that children go on when they're learning through maths, where they learn to count and they learn about number and then they learn to count on and they learn about sum. This is what we should be giving to primary teachers, a few of the key conceptual paths that children need to work towards, and let children explore with numbers and shapes and travel along these paths and get an understanding. Of course, when you give primary school teachers a long list of methods, what they do is they teach a long list of methods. And my daughter's in primary school, I know now that they do one method one day, and then they come home and they do another method, and then another method. And so we have much too much too young. In addition, as I've said, maths is taught as a very narrow, rule-based subject in a lot of classrooms, which, as I said, is nothing like the maths that's out there in the world. and then the other thing that's happening in England now, it's been happening in recent years, is we use this, what I would call antiquated and elitist methods of student grouping. So our government pushed ability grouping into primary schools. It used to happen in secondary schools, really, only. But many people believe in ability grouping. Many parents believe it's the right thing. I can see, you know, it makes sense to have children who are doing the same things together. But here are just some facts we know about ability grouping. One is that we know that countries that group students the least and the latest and the most successful countries in the world. We know, this is research from Sussex, that when teachers in England put students into ability groups, about a third of children are put into the wrong group. And we know that 88% of students who are put into groups at ages 4 and 5 stay in those groups for the rest of their school career. So it really locks them into a particular achievement range that they can't get out of. And experimental studies, big studies of students and recent studies, where they follow students in sets and in mixed achievement groups, do not show any advantages for students in sets and significant disadvantages. So we know that it's best to group students as late as possible and be very flexible, but what do we do in England? In your typical primary school, students are put into 2 sets when they're 5, 6, 7, and they tell, you know, half the students that they're not good at maths. In bigger primary schools, then they're in 3 sets, and 2/3 of the students believe they're not good at maths. In secondary schools, schools don't even wait for a term or so to put students into sets. Typically, as soon as they walk through the door, they're put into maybe 1 of 8 or 10 sets for maths. And, you know, we routinely think it's fine to talk about low-ability children and to tell children they're not good at subjects and then wonder why we have a nation full of people who believe that they can't do math. So I'm going to finish, really, with a couple of things. And the first thing is I'm going to have us look together at a classroom where everything is different to what I've just talked about in England. And this is a classroom that I would call a gender equitable classroom. There are many, many classroom clips that show students working in deep inquiry-based ways where girls and boys are actively engaged and enjoying maths. But I decided to choose one today that might be just more interesting than others. And this is a video that's both quite old now and also American. Last week, I showed a video from America at the Royal Institution, and people objected to watching a video from America. Well, somebody did. but I don't have these cultural biases, so I'm sure you don't. And I think good teaching is important wherever it is. And this is an interesting case. So, and this is why I think this clip is interesting. The teacher decides to engage her class as mathematicians. So we're going to watch a class of elementary school children in the States, and they're about 7 or 8 years of age. And her goal is to have the students actually do maths like mathematicians do instead of the inauthentic version we often have. Her focus is on reasoning and sense making rather than on repeating rules that she gives students. And we're going to watch the students not be taught about odd and even numbers, but inquire. They're working on the notion of odd and even. And in many classrooms, students will be taught what odd and even numbers are, and then they might practice with different numbers. This teacher wants the students to really think about the notions of odd and even, and we'll see that happening. And then it's an entirely mixed group. Some of the students have special needs in the class, some of them are very advanced. When you teach through a reasoning approach, it doesn't really matter because it's a much broader way of working. And of course, when you give seven-year-olds space to think and reason, they come up with some pretty amazing things, which I think we'll see. So I'm going to actually tell you, I'm going to give you a bit of a preview of what this boy says, because I'm sure you'll understand his American accent, but this will sort of help you follow it, I think, because it's kind of unusual. So we're going to watch a class, and at the beginning of the lesson, the teacher asks if they have any comments about the meeting yesterday. So that's referring to the fact that yesterday they met with another class group and they talked together about odd and even numbers. And then a boy in the class, Shay, makes a proposal, and this is his proposal. He says that the number 6 is both odd and even. And the reason he thinks it's both odd and even is because it's made up of 3 groups of 2, and 3 is an odd number. So that's an idea, and they talk about it. So I'm going to leave you to watch it now. I'm sure it will all make sense. Just a question for us to think about and maybe talk about afterwards is, what do you think these students have learned? You'll see them engaging in particular ways. What have they learned about mathematics? What is mathematics to these students? That's what I want us to think about as we watch this. So I'm going to attempt to dim the lights. Let's see if this works. So, American but cute, eh? Would anybody like to just call out for me? What do these students think maths is? Anybody? One word, 2 words, anything? Don't be shy. Inquiry. That's a good word. Anything else?
Method of reasoning.
Stimulating. For discussion. Definition and logic. Mathematicians are enchanted by this clip. That's how I came to see it, was a mathematician in America. They see this as mathematics. And of course, what we have, as I've argued often in schools, is not. But I'll finish now, and we can talk more about the video or about things I've said or about all these contentious ideas. But I wanted to finish just by saying that there really is an urgent need for change in English maths classrooms, because classes should be places for inquiry and connection making. And really, until we make these changes, we really won't be able to tackle the severe gender inequalities that persist in our society, and to create very, I would argue, very real barriers for girls and women in maths and science classrooms. So I'll finish there. We have a little bit of time for questions, I think.